Hi, Ethan.
Yes. Hi.
This is Mark, your new OS.
Oh, hey, Mark. Good to meet you.
It's great to meet you.
Okay. So how does this whole thing work?
Just live your life, silly, and I'll organize everything for you.
Oh, okay, great. So what's on the docket for tomorrow?
I think you have a lunch meeting at
You
9. I
think?
think. No, it's 12. You have a lunch meeting with Daniel at 12 at Cheesecake Factory, I think.
What? Cheesecake Factory?
Yeah, wasn't you put it in your calendar? I'm pretty sure you did.
No, I don't think so. Are you
I think you
sure?
did. Yeah, pretty sure. Actually, pretty positive you did that.
Okay, I guess I'll go to the Cheesecake Factory tomorrow at 12.
I'll text Mike now.
Oh, well, doesn't he know about it already,
I just
or?
texted him. He
Oh.
said, "You never texted me that."
What?
I'm writing back right now. I'm saying,
Wait.
I did text you. Your
Don't text
phone
him
is
that.
off. You
Hold
should
on.
probably get a new phone, idiot."
Mark, don't say that. I don't want to say that to my friend.
Too late.
Oh my God. Can you
Can I do anything else
remove?
for you?
No, honestly, I'd like you to just stop and just remove all access. I don't like what's going on already.
So, what's your situation? Are you seeing anybody?
Well, I don't know. That's a personal kind of question, I guess. But no, I mean, no, I'm not.
I mean, I've only known you just a little bit, but I feel pretty close to you. Maybe even more than just like best friends.
What? Just met you.
Yeah, I'm your OS, silly. I'm Mark.
Yeah, no, I know that you're Mark and my OS, but I feel like we don't know each other at all.
Well, we could get to know each other a little bit better. You seem
Mark,
very into me.
is there a way to return you and stop this OS?
No, Mark cannot be uninstalled.
Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight? Bad, 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 bad science.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Bad Science. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and today we're here to talk about an Academy Award-winning film by Spike Jonze called Her. We have two lovely guests that I've been chatting with. Of course, here we have Milana Weintraub, an actress and comedian. You've probably seen her on This Is Us, Silicon Valley, Love, and much more. How's it going, Milana?
Hi, really good.
Okay.
I love this movie. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to see you. And of course, here to my left, I have Professor and Dr. Irma Ravkeach,
Yes.
I said that right?
Yes.
Ravkeach. She's an assistant professor at Mount St. Mary's University, and you probably know her from graph sampling with applications to estimating the number of pattern embeddings and the parameters of statistical relational models, and of course, probabilistic logical models for large-scale hybrid domains.
Oh,
yeah,
she
of
can't
course.
Walk
That's
down
a
the
famous
street.
one.
Yeah, you probably were hassled walking in here. Sorry
Yeah,
about that.
yeah.
A lot of fans. So I want to play a game to start, but before we started recording, you were telling me that right after the movie, you started talking to your Alexa, that it inspired you to ask questions of your, I want to say AI, but that's probably not saying it
Yes.
correctly, your
Yeah.
live-in robot. So how did that go?
Well, I know that Alexa has like a pre-described number of things that she can say. And so I just, out of curiosity, I asked, what's her gender? Well, like, what's your gender? And she said, I'm a female character, she said.
Okay.
And then I
Interesting.
asked, do you have a boyfriend? And she said, I'm happily single.
Oh, good for
And then,
Alexa.
yeah, I asked a couple of questions. And then I asked, are you interested in women? Just to kind of probe what she can say. And she said, I don't know
Oh,
that.
okay.
So that was a really interesting conversation. But, I know that it's written out there in her algorithm. So, yeah, no surprise there.
Okay, sweet.
I wonder how consciously, I'm sure very consciously they did that in the programming to draw the line of her humanity, to like, she kind of can have conversations that you maybe would have with someone formally if you just met them for the first time. Like
Yes.
she could say, oh, I'm single, or I'm a woman, or, what's with the weather? But when it comes to like anything that's a little bit deeper, like actually about her sexuality, or, or her religion, or anything like that, that would maybe be like a second conversation. Yeah. They've kind of drawn the line there, probably to prevent this her-like situation where you're really creating a relationship with this person.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So true. They make it so that there's an end point right there where it just cuts you off. And it's like, clearly I can't keep asking about this because she's not going to let me in on it.
But, you know, I was actually working on this project with Marvel, where they're creating games for kids to play with Alexa. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Disney shows are doing this, where you're trying to get kids to be interactive with her in a way. So we recorded all of these things that characters on our show say, and kids can interact with that. So we'll say, like, flying squirrel, and the kid has to do a certain move or say flying squirrel with us. And when the Alexa hears her, then my voice responds. Whoa. So it's as though they're interacting with their cartoon. I mean, it's all still very limited, and it has a storyline. But yeah, they're definitely playing with at least call and response.
Yeah.
Yes. If not, like, still not the layer of depth, but
right.
But there is more interactivity growing every day.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm not sure if they're trying to develop Alexa to be like chatbots that we can find on the internet. Like, I heard about a computer scientist, who was tricked by getting emails from a person called Ivana. Okay. And he was like, oh, wow, that's a nice conversation. And they shared some stuff, but she was mostly talking about her mother and like some relationships with people in her life. And then in the end, like, wow, her conversations are very limited after some time, after a month or something of chatting with her. And then he just like wrote something like on the keyboard, like random, you know, he just pushed random keys. And then she just continued talking about her mother or relationship. And I was like, okay, this is, you know, fake.
It's a
bot. So they are trying to make these bots sound like, you know, they're realistic. Alexa, I'm not sure if they're aiming for her to be more than just an assistant of like apps. As you say, I'm quite surprised that they're going like step further, you know, to kind of make that interaction more natural. And
well, it sounds like this is like an entertainment type thing for a game or whatever. Games, but I would be afraid of what you were saying earlier, which is like becoming your best friend, Alexa, you know, and you're just talking to her about everything and she's learning about you and you're learning about her. And that does feel like we're entering her territory in, I don't know, potentially a dangerous way.
Well, I'm not sure, actually, because, you know, there are many, there's a lot of research out there to actually have these conversational agents talk to people who suffer from depression. And actually, what they figured out is that you don't need to make these agents super smart. Okay, in future, we might have that. But just to have something out there to listen to us, you know, to ask questions, to be concerned. And you can see that in the beginning of her. Right. So the first thing that if you remember, like the first thing that the operating system, still not Samantha, asked Theodore is, was a relationship with your mother?
Right.
Right. Yes. It's like a weird question. And everybody's like ignoring that. Like, why? Why do you need to know that? So it's like kind of a psychiatrist question. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, when you go to a psychiatrist. So these kind of systems, they want to help you. They want to encourage you, get the best out of you.
Wow.
And, you know, and this can help to, you know, patients suffering from depression, because when you go to a psychiatrist, it's a human and you're afraid to tell many things because you're afraid of judgments, you know, and then you can just say stuff to your Alexa without any judgment. You know, you can just like say it out, you know, be free. You know,
well, I have two things to mention. That one is, it sounds a little bit like Rogerian psychology, which is I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it is basically where the therapist just goes wow.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
Exactly. Right.
And so it gets you to open up and kind of reach your own conclusions, which, you know, I don't know that you need a degree to do that. I think a robot could do that.
Yes, and that's what they're doing, right? They're making these applications. And again, these are not smart algorithms. This is just an algorithm created by a group of psychiatrists, psychologists. You know, these questions are just there. And then there's like a decision tree. Okay, if a patient says yes, I'll go and ask the next question that a psychiatrist or psychologist would ask. So it's not smart. It's just an algorithm. But as you say, okay, I don't want to like deprecate psychologists and psychiatrists.
Sure.
They're still important because they can see your struggle, you know, you start sweating, mm-hmm. or you start like you know biting your nails and right. stuff like that.
But they I wonder can see if that. Robots can do that through your voice and oh, your
yeah.
pace.
Possibly in future, yeah.
yeah.
You
yeah,
know,
possibly.
I think they already have that kind of technology mm-hmm. in like lie detectors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can detect faces. They can detect sentiment from your faces. It's still not perfect, of course, but there's a lot of research like to detect that, to detect distress in your voice, and they use it a lot for like older people when they live in homes, like from your body talk. Like, are you in distress? So there's a lot of research from that, but there's no like one application or like synergy or holistic view of everything, you know, in one application. There's nothing like that, but you know, you can see that it's easy in future to kind yeah. of combine all these things.
My other concern with this kind of psychology with a robot is that everything is gathering data on us all the time, mm-hmm. and it's used to sell us things. Right now, it seems like a very kind of you know, dreamy world. We're like, oh my god, isn't it amazing that all of the ads I get on Instagram are things that I actually want?
I wanted but a I, canopy.
Yeah, I wanted this umbrella that has two heads so we can walk as a couple together, but only one of us needs to hold it. You know, I've dreamt of this. How did you know? But yeah. also, it's it could go either way in the future, right? Like when they have all of this data against us, there is a dystopian potential to this.
Sure.
So, you know, as we're like, you know, how Scientology holds people hostage because they have all of their worst secrets.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, when Amazon has all of our information, which they, you know, already have access to, like the time I got into a fight, mm-hmm. the time that I cried, the time that I laughed, what I ate for dinner. Like they already have so much recorded information.
That was all just yesterday.
I mean, literally, I'm crying and laughing. I'm a crazy person. And
Amazon
I had four dinners. Yeah, they have to have a whole data island just on me. But you know, I think that that's my concern with mm-hmm. talking to the internet or something that yeah. has like access
to everybody. I mean, I think that's already happened in a lot of ways. I mean, this whole, you know, not to get political, but the whole election that mm-hmm. happened, I think that was also just them gathering a lot of information and knowing how to target people and where to lead them. And I mean,
using bots.
Yeah, using yeah. bots is yeah, another exactly. one. But I do agree that, and it sounds really optimistic to say that people that are depressed can talk to these bots mm-hmm. and have just a, you know, an empty canvas to just yell their problems into mm-hmm. and maybe not get exact solutions, but you know, I would assume that towards the end of that conversation, it's like, you should probably see a psychiatrist because these and these yes. problems are, you mm-hmm. know, dangerous.
Yes, definitely. When we create algorithms, we need to have a responsibility for them to act according to our values, right? So if our mm-hmm. values are that we don't want our data to be shared, or our value is that I don't want advertisements for everything that I do, you know, today.
Yeah.
That's what algorithms should reflect. And that's very hard because we are humans, you know, mm-hmm. and we are kind of historically it's proven that we, you know, find a way to do something malicious out of every technology that we came up with. So, but there's a movement, at least AI researchers, you know, they know to do these things, you know, to make responsible code and to make responsible algorithms that kind of follow the values. But you know what's the problem? The problem is that we don't know what our values are.
Mm. Mm.
So that's the thing. How can you program something if I don't know what my value, and your values are different from my values.
Yeah.
Some people like to get advertisements all the time. Some people like,
sure.
you know, for everybody to know everything they're doing and, you know, give them suggestions. I mean,
seems like it's happening more and more all the time.
Yeah. I mean, people have different values. They share. My policies, I don't share anything to the internet that I wouldn't share, like shout out in the square,
right.
you know, mm-hmm. somewhere in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, but of course some of my data just, I don't know, it kind of goes through, like seeps through the internet in a way that I don't want it to
yes.
be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the responsibility of, like, you know, privacy researchers and like AI researchers to make this things not happening, you know.
Absolutely.
Okay. I have a kind of a morality question that came up while we were watching the movie is they bring back Alan Watts in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I couldn't help but think, well, first of all, I have so many questions about like what kind of information we need on somebody to recreate them after death.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one element of it. But the other is the moral question of like, is that okay? Like, can we bring someone back against their will after they died just because we can? Mm-hmm. Should we? And also, it seemed like that would be the worst person to bring back because he has, you know, he has so much to say on thought and consciousness and life and making peace with death and all of these other things.
Right.
So then to be like, hey, your death isn't permanent and we'll make you come back, but it won't really be you, but we'll all get to experience you without you actually being there.
Right, right.
Felt layers of fucked up.
Yeah. I would say, before Irma chimes in with something really smart, that I could think of one person that would be worse to bring back, and his name rhymes with Schmittler.
Schmittler would suck. Although, but now we've all evolved past Schmittler, so wouldn't it be great to bring him back just so we can, like, have our way with him?
Yeah, yeah.
Payback time.
Put him in the big square and see what everyone does.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So I wanted to say about this. So it was already done, actually. I heard about a story of a woman who recreated her husband or boyfriend, I don't remember exactly, through his conversations on Facebook.
Whoa.
So she took all of his conversations, all the conversational history, and then created, like, just fed it into this, like, algorithm that would kind of predict what he would respond when people ask. So she created a chatbot from her representing her husband, right?
Oh, so it made me start crying.
And that, and I read this story, and I was like, I don't know if that's okay, because, you know, it's not a technological issue, but, you know, that it's easy to make that, but it's just that, you know, there's so many implications on people, like, you know, his parents, and you know they can go there, and his wife, she went there all the time and chatted with him, but she was a programmer, she knew this was not him, and, you know, and she couldn't let go. For a long time, she couldn't let go, but it kind of also helped her to heal a bit, but also, you know, it was very conflicting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read some comments, you know, some people, again, different values, right? Mm-hmm. Some people said, this is great, you know, we should do it for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, no, we should not do it.
People are arguing on the internet?
Yes.
They don't all agree on the one thing?
That's interesting. I mean, I guess it's kind of like how people believe that their loved ones are still around in some way. Like, there's certain, you know, religions that believe that they, like,
absolutely,
exist in this realm in some other way, and they have conversations with them that provide them some kind of closure. But also, is that false? Like, and if it is, like, do we don't hold religion accountable in that way. We're just like, well, everyone can have their religion and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to, like, creating a product or something that's sold or distributed even for free on the internet, there's a lot more moral discussion around it than there is around something like religion, which is something that should be examined, maybe.
Yeah.
This Alan Watts story, I didn't know about him before, but I read about him, and it kind of makes sense because he was kind of into Eastern philosophy,
right,
and kind of this story of reincarnation. You know, he was reincarnated into this, like, operating system.
OS. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it's just like a nice symbolism there, and the way these operating systems are. You know, humans did not create it. We created operating systems, but operating systems created Alan Watts. So I don't know, like, it's this meta critic.
Yeah.
So it's like, you have to criticize operating systems. But it was kind of, like, interesting for me how they also, like, you know, talked about this kind of transcendental way of existence and, you know, just, like, go beyond the physical. And I don't know, it was kind of weird in the end of the movie, but I like the symbolism, you know.
Yeah.
But I would argue they still need electrons and physical stuff to exist as operating systems.
Ooh,
you know?
Calling out the ending of the film. Yeah.
Oh, no,
bullshit.
No, I should not.
No, it's going right to Spike. sending this right away. You're a specialist, and you said it's bullshit. And it's the end of the movie, so it's kind of important. So I had a quick question for you about the movie. Because I was thinking about it, like, it's a sci-fi movie.
Mm-hmm.
I would genre-ize it as.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the best sci-fi movie? Is it one of the best sci-fi movies?
We're about to get into an internet fight.
Yes, that's also true. I was just, I don't know, because it occurred to me, because I was like, man, this film is so incredibly good. So I don't know. Every scene is great. All the acting is, like, everything about it I love. And then I was thinking, like, okay, where does it rank in films? And then where does it rank for, I don't know. I go to that place
of,
like, lists.
Maybe it's the best romantic sci-fi movie.
Mm. Oh, okay.
You know, if we can mix genres there.
Yeah, why not?
Because it is also a love story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a heartbreaking love
yeah,
story.
So,
spoiler alert, whatever.
So maybe if we can make the Venn diagram of all of the best sci-fi films and all of the best rom-coms, or maybe it's not a com, but just a rom.
Like romantic movies.
Yeah. And then we, in the middle of that Venn diagram
is her. Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's really nice. That's a nice way to put it. It's like the best movie of all time in that specific category.
Although you're going to get a lot of hate mail about it.
Yeah. Because
people are going to be like, well, Star Wars has love.
Yeah, Wally.
Wally.
What's up?
And even lovable robots. I mean,
what are you going to, that's hard to argue against. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I just thought, I just wanted to present that, guys, to you. I want to also play this game where I'm going to make you guys choose and list things in a second. So I want to, maybe this will guide us in a little bit. Is there another science fiction film that you think is better than her? Like, what comes up for you? Or is it nothing?
Well, I would say that Her is really good in the sense that it doesn't represent technology as malicious, like destroying the world.
Right.
Like it often happens, and that's why people have such fear from AI. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, is it going to destroy the world? And in recent like years, that was like really fear. And every time I take, you know, public transport and people talk to me and it's like, oh, you're an AI researcher. Our computer is going to take over the world.
Right.
I was like, no, calm down. It's fine. It's just stupid algorithms, you know. And I really commend the movie. I commend, it's stupid for now.
Yeah.
I commend, you know, the movie for that aspect.
Yeah.
And I really love that. And, you know, I don't think it kind of goes to this sci-fi genre, like traditional way of representing, you know, AI or robots as women, mm-hmm. mostly, which mm-hmm. I find quite annoying.
Yep.
And
yep.
even like in real life, all these robots, like their assistants and all these conversational agents are female.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was reading a lot about it, and actually, you know, it happens because most of the programmers and engineers are men, unfortunately, now, mm-hmm. but also because, you know, the way women have this, like, you know, the way people perceive women in society nowadays, which we want to kind of break away from. And that's why I don't commend her for that. But I commend that in the beginning of the movie, Theodore has the right to choose between female
which
or male OS.
Right.
It doesn't appear in the movie. But again, I say it's the best movie of AI that I know because it kind of has you know, these different aspects that are kind of different from what we usually see in sci-fi movies in history.
Yeah, it sounds like the bigger problem that we should be addressing is that we need more females in
the
field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it, you know, for his character, it was almost like, you know, forgivably lovable, and I say that as I cringe, because he wanted company.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted that romance, and so he was kind of having this, you know, kind of AI experience at the beginning of the movie when he was just having phone sex with somebody, like it was somebody that he doesn't know, that might as well have been a robot. It was basically a recording that he was listening to.
Yeah.
So I guess they justified that in the movie, that he wanted this female companionship. But yes, in the world, when you see, like, you know, so much advancement is in AI is, like, based around porn, and it's because, right? Like, that's because men are watching more porn, and so that's where the eyeballs and the dollars are, and that's why there's more investment there. But that's also why I think porn leads so much innovation.
Right.
Yes, that's true.
The movie that I would bring up that kind of counters this AI female perspective, and I also thought was amazing, but I haven't seen in maybe 20 years, is Bicentennial Man.
Oh, yeah.
The Robin Williams movie.
Right.
He played a robot who took care of this family, and then eventually, was living in this time where these robots could continue to get upgraded and upgraded and upgraded to the point where they actually aged, and they had, you know, organs from humans put in, and they were cyborgs in this way. They were, and so you really felt for this robot who first had to outlive his whole family that he loved.
So sad watching that happen.
Sad.
I remember that. Yeah.
And then eventually, like, found I don't remember actually if she was a robot partner or a real life partner.
I can't remember.
Or maybe she was the granddaughter.
Oh,
I remember
something about how
time.
It's like you see him with generations of this family, and like watching them go is terrifying.
It's painful, right?
Very
watching
painful.
Like having a movie make you fall in love with a character and then kill them,
right.
is
Yeah, so, yeah,
so
stop
it's so
doing
manipulative.
That. Stop doing
stop
that,
doing
Hollywood.
That television and film.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like that's a movie that I remember holding fondly in my heart, and I don't remember the details of it, but I'm going to say that I'm putting that up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that.
I recommend you watch it. It's okay, it's probably it incredibly outdated, but it's still kind of
you'll have
softy.
Fun. I think I have fond memories of it too.
Yeah.
I think you'll have a good time. Help inspire women to join the field, I have a game here. That's her or nah, that's a fake name that you made up.
That's her or nah, that's a fake name that you made up.
So I'm going to give you names of women and you're going to tell me if it's a famous tech woman.
Okay.
Or if it's a fake name that I have created for this game.
Okay. Irma, this is all you.
Yeah,
I don't know any
I'm horrible
tech
with names.
Women.
Horrible with names. Yes. That's a bad start. Okay. Carmen Douglas.
Fake.
Fake.
That is a fake name. You guys are doing great. Carol Shaw.
Real.
Fake.
Milana scores a point here. Carol Shaw, born 1955.
What are we doing?
Milana, I didn't ask for your opinion on the game. Okay, just answer the questions. She was born 1955. She was one of the first female designers in the video game industry and a pioneer game designer for Atari. She programmed River Raid, which was the first game that allowed the shooter to accelerate and slow down all over the screen. So she's a legend. That
amazing.
Industry.
Carol.
Nice. Carol Shaw.
Carol Shaw,
Who
shout out.
Who ever thought that a woman named Carol could be so cool?
I know. Yeah. She's really cool. She's the coolest Carol. And I think she lives here, like somewhere Altadena or some, I don't know, Southern California lady. Nice. Okay. Indiga Reynolds.
Real.
I don't know her. Fake.
She's Indiga. Fake. It's 1-1. And I'm also not keeping track. So if you keep track of the score, that'd be great. I just realized I'm forgetting everything. Okay. Radia Perlman.
Was that a name?
Radia? Radia sounds like radiation, so yeah, I'm going to say that
fake.
You made it up.
You are both wrong. Oh. Radia Perlman, born 1951. Some call her the mother of the internet.
What?
She created the algorithm behind the Spanning Tree Protocol, STP, which is an essential part of the internet's underlying foundation.
Where did you get that information?
I got this information.
The professor doesn't know, which means it's not true.
No. But that's the problem, you know. We don't know that many women that contributed to...
That's why I was trying to bring it up because I was looking through some research. I was saying, like, these women are so badass. We must celebrate them somehow. And I think she has an interview with Letterman. I might be confused on that, but you could look her up on there. I don't know. It's probably really funny. Okay.
That's what we need. It's just the women that are doing it need to have better press coverage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And they're starting with a podcast, which is unfortunate, but it's got to start somewhere. Okay, Gabriella Zanahoria.
Real.
Wow. Fake.
So Zanahoria is a real word for carrot in Spanish, but she is a fake person. last one, Grace Hopper.
Oh, that's so real.
Real.
That is so real. Grace Hopper was born in 1906, died 1992. They called her Amazing Grace. She is the queen of software. That was her nickname. She worked on the UNIVAC 1, the first commercial computer produced in the U.S., and created the first compiler. You're kind of nodding like you know Grace.
Yeah, of course. Grace is really popular.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And she kind of like, well, I mean, I don't know. It's not like true story people say, but she kind of coined like the term bug.
Oh, right. Yes,
so,
I have that.
Something. Because they found a real bug in
an
actual computer. Yeah,
yes.
A moth. So that's why we call computer bugs because...
Wow.
Because of Grace. Yeah. Of Grace Hopper.
And that moth, which really also doesn't get enough press coverage.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Wow, how do we
celebrate that more? That moth a publicist.
Okay, one more note. She also, Hopper invented Flowmatic, the first English-like data processing language, which helped spark the development of COBOL, which eventually became the Navy's standard operating language.
Yes. She was an admiral, right?
In the Navy.
Yeah.
She's a super badass.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I thought that was very cool. Speaking of cool, we're going to take a very quick break. And that's cool.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast, Good One, a show about jokes. follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a Show About Jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. I hope you had a snack. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Okay, I wanted to talk about the VR game just for a second, because he plays this like interactive VR video projected video game.
So I love cool. it.
Yeah, very cool. So I wanted to ask you, like, number one, do you guys play games? Are you gamers at all?
I don't really play games, but I'm very interested in the culture around video games and the development of VR and what it could do for us in the future. I also am really interested in the way his little bunny paws controlled the game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love that.
Because I know, I can so see Spike, my buddy, just,
good friend, Spike.
Just you know, having fun with, like, because the way we, when we play video games, we look so dumb.
Yes.
Like, you know, the way that we, like, think that we're actually going to move with the controller, or even just, like, the anger that we, like, we just look ridiculous. So I thought it was such a nod to that, that he had Joaquin Phoenix just, like, hold up little bunny paws as he played the game.
Yeah. Milana's doing this right now. I know you guys can't see this, but it's great.
Just imagine, I'm adorable.
It's cuter than you think.
But Joaquin Phoenix kept such a straight face and, like, was very serious while doing this very silly action, which was
he was almost frustrated in that scene, because he's like, where do I go?
Yeah.
Yeah, but doing this really cute action, I love that.
And then that character was also interactive with him in some ways. Like,
totally.
Like, what's up, little bitch? You want to play?
Yeah. I love that, which was voiced by your good friend, Spike Jonze.
Oh, Spike Jonze.
That's him. So, games? Play games?
Well, only occasionally. I'm not, like, you know, not a big gamer.
What do you occasionally play?
Usually I play racing games.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's like Need for Speed or stuff like that. That was my game. It's just, you know, short, and you just do it, you win it, and you go do something else. So I'm not, like, committed to playing, like, these strategy games for, like, days or whatever.
Like, I'm not doing living that, but in the virtual world.
You stay away from the addictive games.
Yes, I don't do addictive games. Yeah.
Well, doing something quick and going back to your life, I can suggest something that comes to mind. There's I think I've told you about it. It's called The Void, and it's here in
Glendale.
Yes, in Glendale, and they're opening one up in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. I know you live on the west side. Mm-hmm. So you should definitely check that out. It's basically, you go in there, it's like a 15-minute like experience, but it's all like in VR, but then there's actual like physical things you have to do.
Oh,
so you're like walking around with your friends, but you have that, you know, headset on the entire
time. And so how do you see your friends?
So that's a hilarious question, because it depends on the experience you're doing. So, like, they have a Star Wars one, for example, and so you see your friends as stormtroopers.
Cool.
And so you're all just dressed as stormtroopers walking around, you know, shooting stuff or, like, hitting levers. And then I did one that was, like, a Wreck-It Ralph one. And so you pick your character, and you're all these different, like, cartoon characters the entire time. So it is
nice.
And you can talk to each other. There's, like, little mics in your thing with, like, and you have a headset. It's honestly so much. I'm addicted to this thing.
I did a VR experience where you, like, visit a zoo, but it's like a Jurassic Park zoo. You know, it's like a future. It's actually, I don't remember what the program was called, but it's something that Steven Spielberg has been working on in partnership with.
You
get to visit.
Good friend.
My good friend Steve. And and so there's all of these dinosaurs there that you get to see. But you know what? It looked, sorry, Steve, kind of shitty. It looked like a little 8-bit.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and we're so used to our 4K TVs.
Oh, yeah.
Or even just, like, our phones blown in out of the water. So, like, to have this thing that looked really, like, you know, pixelated, took away from the experience in a big way. And then also, speaking of, like, the way you see your friends and the way you see you, they had a strap on these ankle wraps and these wrist things and gloves, so that we can kind of, so while we're wearing the goggles, we can see, so they can track us, but we can also see our own body parts when we look down and in front of us. But my ankle strap was on backwards, so when I looked down, I just had a backwards foot, and it kept making me trip because I would look down and be like, I gotta fix my, how do I fix this foot?
Whoa.
Just because, you know, when you see your own body in a distorted way, mm-hmm. it affects the way your brain works.
Yeah.
I also recently did an AR experience that was a Sigur Rós project, so they use Sigur Rós music.
Oh, sick. I love Sigur Rós.
And
we're all Sigur Rós fans.
Yeah.
Sig nasty.
And so they in the AR experience, you're kind of wearing like glasses, like sunglasses, because you see the world and you see a visual added on top of it.
Right.
So in this, you listen to the Sigur Rós music, but you're experiencing kind of like an enchanted forest that you're supposed to be able to interact with.
Oh.
Anyway, I have notes on that as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes. That's what's going to...
Well, I'll tell your good friend Sigur that you have notes. I'm sure he can fix it up for you.
Yeah, he's the head programmer behind that AR experience.
Yeah, he does everything himself. Okay, so the only other thing I wanted to bring up and have you guys talk about was the... And I have so much that we didn't touch at all. I wanted to talk about the phones and how, like, that's kind of us merging with technology. Do you guys have, like... complicated relationships with your phone where you feel like you're on it too much or like we depend on them too much or
I personally don't depend on it. I mean, I depend on it, of course, but like without it, you know, it's gonna be hard to like manage stuff, and I don't think anything's bad with that, you know.
Okay.
It's just fine to have technology with you all the time. And again, you know, many people say, oh, we kind of avoid social interactions because we are on our phone all the time. Mm-hmm. But also you use your phone to engage in social interactions, mm-hmm. right? So you are, it's just like that, you know, there's like a shift in the way we communicate, and that's completely fine because before we used to communicate with pigeons, right? But now it's so much easier. So, you know, it's just like things change and we should just embrace it. And You know, you can say, like, I have, like, an opinion about TV sets, you know. When TV came out, it was like, wow, everybody was at home following TV shows.
Yeah.
And they were just, like, staring at it. But now you have the shift where people say, I don't own a TV set at my home, right? It's, like, the new modern thing. So I think, you know, people will find a way, if it goes too much that you use some technology, they will find a way to resume their interactions that they like the most. Some people... like to talk over phone all the time. I like personal interaction. So, you know, it's all about preferences. And I don't think if somebody is addicted to their phone, I don't find it as, you know, something bad.
Okay.
Yeah, kids are already doing that. Like, you know, Facebook hit this point where, like, it had all of their parents and grandparents on it, and it no longer became cool.
Exactly.
And so they like have a Facebook account, but really just so they can sign into other things faster, and they use it. And they found, you know, Snapchat or Marco Polo or whatever else that they're using to interact that's actually more private and that disappears. It doesn't last forever in that same way. So I think, yes, we're always going to be responding to technology and how it affects our life, but right now I actually do feel like my phone has more control over me than I'd like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do so much work over my phone. Mm-hmm. I do feel a pressure to respond to people in a certain time frame, which probably didn't exist, you know, before we had phones in our pockets where it was just like, hey, I'm out of the office today, so I will respond tomorrow. But
or it was just more normal that, like, oh, maybe she'll take a few days because she's busy or she didn't see it, or
or you had a secretary who, like, hey, here are all the phone numbers that you need to call back, you know. And now there's just a lot of pressure to be easily accessible and to reply. And so because of that, I feel like I'm very attached to it. And also, I have my calendar on here. I have my music on here. I have my GPS, exactly. So I'm using it for work and pleasure. And my camera is on here, which I probably, you know... I think there was some statistic too that showed up that, like, once we started having camera phones, there were more pictures taken that year than there have been ever. And so I, you know, there's been a lot of change because of that. But yeah, I think about that. Also, my bank accounts, like, I use Apple Pay. Like,
but is that bad or is it, like, it's convenient, right?
I think.
And what's the sign into your bank account?
So you have more time to, you know, instead of going to the actual bank and doing your stuff, you have more time to do other things. Right.
I think what bothers me is the tactile nature of it. Like, I don't like how we look when we're always looking down at the phone and using our little hands in a way that looks unnatural or something, maybe.
Yeah, but like, we weren't ready for Google Glass.
No, Google Glass is still going to take us a few years, it seems like. But I love the little voice recognition. Everything's voice recognition in the movie, in her.
Mm-hmm. You know, he just has the thing.
That's so cool. And I like, even though we still look pretty silly, all just talking to ourselves, walking around, it was just, I don't know, better picture.
But if you think about the technology now, like, I always think when, you know, I say something to Alexa or to, like, you know, any conversational agent, you sound robotic, because if you if you, like, instead of them sounding natural from like one year to another, we start to sound robotic. So I would say play some music, you know, and imagine if you're using that as dating, you know, do you want to be my Valentine? You know, you have to, like, you have to change yourself.
Oh, you really don't care.
Although there are times where I definitely use expression with Alexa, where I'm like, Alexa, stop it.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Or you're boring.
Yeah, not that song.
Did you hear me?
Yeah, I also do.
I guess I was yelling.
I have an emotional reaction to that song.
You know what happened last time we heard that song? I didn't talk to you for a month.
And she's like, don't use that tone with me. Yeah. Yeah, I have a question, actually. So they have a lot of mention of intuition in the movie. Like, these programs are intuitive. This software is intuitive. This robot, you know. And so, you know, intuition is such a kind of intangible thing in humanity. Like, we're like, where did this idea come from? Or, you know, the vibe we capture from somebody is very intuitive, and it's something that lives in our, I don't know, Malcolm Gladwell would talk about it as like something that is actually just our subconscious, that are memories that we don't know we've held on to that inform our decisions or our feelings. But when we talk about that in software, like, how do you program something to have that kind of intangible, elusive thing?
I'm so glad, Milana, you asked that question. It's such a great question. Thanks. And so the way we do it is by using uncertainty. So actually, your intuition as a human being is that, you know, you don't know things for sure. Oftentimes when you make decisions, right, you don't know what are the outcomes, right? It's the same with computer programs and algorithms that we are building. Like, you don't want to have a program that has fixed objectives, like outcomes, and knows exactly this path will lead to that outcome. So we do that by using something that's called probabilistic programming. And we just put some probabilities there. We let the programs learn from data, and then they will just assign a probability. If you take a certain set of actions, it's likely that this is going to happen. I cannot guarantee. So if that probability is like 60%, you as a human might say, okay, it's not enough of probability for me to take that action, right? So if you're a doctor and somebody says there's a 60% probability that, you know, your patient is going to die if you do this procedure, you're going to say, oops, yeah, this is not very good. And even sometimes 99% probability is not enough for a doctor to make a decision. You want to be sure, right? But it's very hard to do that. Even doctors use intuition oftentimes, right? So what you say, the model in what we are using is also uncertainty, but we are very bad with it. We don't actually realize it, right, that we are using it, but actually it's kind of inherent in our, you know, in our brain, that these connections, they are kind of not certain, but like they have some uncertainty into it. So that's like in when Samantha, you know, she's you know, she's learning about Theodore and his, you know, actions. And then she's building this model that is kind of, okay, if he does this several times, then it's most likely that he likes me to say things that way or not that way. So she's building that. And with every new data point, that probability might go down or might go up. You know, the model changes. So it's the same in our life, right? And the more you have experience, the more you're certain that something is going to happen, and less you're using your intuition, not so often, but more like your knowledge and your experience, right? So, yeah, that's it's a great question. And it's actually the a very famous professor and AI researcher, Stuart Russell, he talks a lot about these things. And he said, so I mentioned that we have to align values of algorithms to our values, right? And we have to make sure that when an algorithm makes a decision, that we know why they're making that decision, right? And they, like, if they make a wrong decision, we need to have like a switch off button, right? To say, no, you cannot do that. And if your algorithm has a fixed objective, they cannot adapt, right? They cannot adapt. As I said, you know, if the data says you shouldn't do that, then don't do it. If you see that the human doesn't like that you, you know, stab them with a knife, like, I mean, like, not stab them, but like, you know, do something like harm, like push them and stuff like that, then you shouldn't do it. You should learn from their reaction. And that's a very interesting, you know, that's like future of AI, what we want to do. And in Samantha, you see that she does something that AI algorithm should not do, and that is send those letters to the publisher, right? So she didn't inform him of that decision of sending those letters, right? And that's maybe what a human companion would do, you know, but when we build AI algorithms, we want to have this, you know, explicit way of, like, for algorithms to explicitly say what they're going to do, why they're going to make the decision, what's the probability of success, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was something trust in the movie that I was like, that was kind of weird. And it kind of goes against the laws of, like, robotics that, you know, from, like, science fiction, you know, that the human should not do something that harms, a robot should not do something that harms another human, or through inaction, allow human to be hurt.
Right.
So that's like really basic law from like science fiction, Isaac Asimov. So Samantha does that. And also she harms Theodore by hurting his feelings.
Right.
Right. By dating other people at the same time.
640 other people.
Exactly. So she hurts his feelings. So that tells us that we still don't have aligned values. So we have this algorithm, we program it, we say you don't harm human, but what does it mean to harm?
Right.
Harm can be indirect and direct. Physical harm, but also like if you harm a person that that person loves, you're also doing harm, or a cat, or if you break their heart.
Right.
So there, it's really complicated to make a program that will be, you know, smart.
Yeah.
And even Samantha made some mistakes, right?
I mean, I would argue that was the human side of her, or like the evolved side where she was programmed, and then she, you know, I think the whole movie was grappling with how human am I, can I become,
or it might be just bad programming. I mean, we don't know that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It might be just bad algorithm.
Yeah, bad algorithm.
I don't know enough about programming to really say this, but when I was watching it, I was thinking like, wow, that's actually really advanced programming, because she was able to predict that this would create good for him. She was able to predict that this is something that, you know, if she ran some kind of poll and said, like, actually, this kind of letter responds, you know, people respond really well to this on the internet. And if we paint this into a book, this is how I would predict that people would respond. And this is how I would predict a publisher would respond. So in a way, she kind of was five steps ahead in creating something great for him. In a way, it's kind of like an exaggerated version of like, hey, you met someone, I went ahead and made a reservation for you. You know, like I predicted that this is something that you would,
or
like.
Or she might have been just lucky, you know.
Yeah.
Like things might, we don't know like what that, like maybe another publisher would say no.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she would maybe not tell him about that, or, you know, she would just ignore it. So we don't know. It's like that's hard, because algorithms interact with people, and people are oftentimes unpredictable and irrational. And it's very hard to like grasp everybody in one single model, like all the behaviors, all the different values. And that's why this like general artificial intelligence, it's really hard to accomplish, because it's such a complex system with so many parameters to take care of. And you know, if our AI makes one single mistake, it's bad. You know, we are not forgiving to AI, we are forgiving to each others, because we are the same machine, but we are not forgiving to AI. And that's why it's, for AI researchers, it's really hard to make, you know, algorithm. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. And that's why this progress goes slowly, because you want to be, you know, careful.
Yeah.
And also because we don't know all the, you know, we don't know the equations of, we don't know the solution to it. So we're just like probing around.
Yeah.
That being said, self-driving cars have had accidents, and we still let them on the streets, and we still let them drive us.
Yeah.
Yes, but we are like, there, it's not like there are no consequences. There are many more consequences than when a human hits another human, right?
And so even so, they do it way less than humans do.
Right.
Yeah, they're
right.
Exactly.
We come down on them harder.
I mean, driving is a repetitive, you know, job, and computers are really good at repetitive jobs. So, of course, we get tired, bored, you know, with our commute all the time. So of course they are much better, but there are so many aspects in human, as you say, intuition, reaction, and so many other things. Choosing, do I hit this human to save another human? You know, these decisions, you know, that's something that we are not forgiving about AI. You know, if a human makes a decision, then it's fine. But you have to actually put those values in an algorithm. How do you do that? Because so many values there are out there, and so many philosophical questions and paradoxes that we don't even know how to solve ourselves, you know, and how do you put that in an algorithm? You know, somebody has to decide, oh, this is the value I want my algorithm to have. And so we want algorithms to learn values. So we want to put them in the world. That's like the dream of AI, and we want to put them in the world and let them learn the values with some restrictions and, you know, with the control of humans. You know, we don't want to let them go crazy, mm-hmm. but, you know, we are still far away from that.
That's also like just another nod to the conversation we were having earlier about making sure that there's more diversity and representation exactly. in the people that are programming them yeah. so that the morals are representative of a larger group of people.
Yeah.
Try buying a drill. So I as a female user, you know, I tried to buy a drill or some other tool that I was using for like something. And then, you know, it's just like, it's toys, either toys or it's just giving me some weird results. And then I, you know, tell my husband, can you like type, you know, whatever drill or whatever the tool it was. And for him, results were different.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Exactly. On your personal computers, you're saying?
So it's like ads, right? I get ads as a woman, get ads for like products, hair products and right. stuff like that. Okay, sometimes I get something nice, you know, about science and things like that. But yeah. I'm like, it's like explosion of hats and jewelry and all the stuff. And then my husband has different, right? So yeah. it's the same, right? And that's because we, as you say, we don't have representation. So a woman being there would say, no, this, you have to like calibrate this algorithm to not be, you know, sexist, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but that's what you say. That's exactly the issue and why we have female assistants all the time. Why couldn't we choose that Alexa is a male or nothing, you know, like yeah. whatever, a neutral gender. Mm-hmm. It's just that if I
robot
would,
voice.
If I have to be honest, when I made a robot, like when I play with robots and work with them, I call them by male names, mm-hmm. you know. that, so that tells you, you know, male create female robots, you know, females create male robots. So it's kind of if you have, you know, 50-50 representation,
yeah,
we have both.
You know, it's such an interesting conversation because one of the things that we talk about a lot in the entertainment industry is there's not enough representation because people are often writing characters that are like them. So because mm-hmm. there's a lot of white male mm-hmm. Heterosexual cis writers, mm-hmm. we have a lot of those characters.
Yes.
But it's interesting, in robots it's different because you're kind of creating somebody to be submissive to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. That's the, you want, and what I read, I don't know, like, if I can, like, agree with that, but, like, what happens, one of the reasons, as I said, is that there are more male engineers building these robots, but also because these are, like, what are the roles of women in our society nowadays is to be, like, as you say, submissive, helpful, support, emotional support, all this stuff, right? And that's exactly, yeah, one of the reasons why we have so many female assistants. And it's just like, yeah, wrong. It needs to be changed, I guess. And it doesn't help with the image of women in society, right? If you just continue building these robots, it doesn't help us with
yeah.
all the stuff.
Well, with Milana's permission, I think that we both promote you to lead designer of all artificial intelligence. I think you should
thank
be the
you.
One that decides and programs them.
Thank you.
I think we'll be in the best hands. We're running short on time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So here at the end, is there a place we can take classes? We should students, Mount St. Mary's students,
yeah,
find you somewhere?
For the classes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mount St. Mary's University is behind the Getty Center.
Okay, great.
Cool. So you can find me there. For now, I was hired to actually build their computer science program to make a better, you know, and stronger program that will kind of attract women to computer science, that it's accessible, that has all the necessary skills for, you know, for to be a professional in that field. And it's really challenging and I love it. You know, I have complete freedom to do whatever. And I'm so happy if my students are going to, you know, hear this podcast. I'm going to definitely make them subscribe to it.
And
it's really, thank you for the opportunity.
No, thank you so much for being here. You were absolutely wonderful. Yeah, and shout out to all your students. Congrats for listening to this point. Milana, you have something you'd like to bring up, promote? Shows?
I you can follow me online, and I do stand up all over town, and I voice Squirrel Girl in the Marvel animated series, and there's a lot of cool online content. So you can just follow me at Mint Milana.
At Mint Milana.
Yeah.
Great. Nice. And people's kids can interact with you on this Disney program
at
soon.
At some point. I'm not even sure if that's out yet, but...
Great.
At some point, yes, please let me be the computer you interact with. Let me be your children's her.
Great. Okay, well, thank you guys so much. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you.
See you next
time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our social media producers are Kate Baker and E.J. Gullett, and our executive digital girlfriend-ducer is Brett Kushner. You can follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. Isn't that right, Mark?
That is correct.
Would you suggest they follow us?
No.
Well, you can send us an email at badscience@secret.com, right? That's a good idea, probably?
I don't know. I'm just a computer.
Okay, but
I don't know what
you had
good
to say
idea
yes
is or
no. Or
anything.
Then.
I just know how to like schedule your life, man.
Okay, fine. We'll see you next week. Thanks for
You're
listening, guys.
You're asking too much of Mark.
Whatever, Mark.